your computer's online. Archiving 44K. Initiate sequence.
T minus 30 seconds.
Server connection confirmed.
T minus 25 seconds.
Live stream for QNN20K.
T minus 20 seconds.
Phone lines are go.
T minus 15 seconds.
Satellite uplink verified.
T minus 10 seconds.
Flight check complete. Satellite uplink verified.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Black Op Radio, the voice of political conspiracy research. You're listening to Black Op Radio, the show NSA doesn't want you to hear. Now here is your host, Leno Sanic.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Black Op Radio. This is your host, Leno Sanic. We're speaking to researcher and author of many articles, Andrew A. Eiler. Welcome, Andrew.
Good evening, Len. It's great to be with you.
Great. Thank you for making time today. And the first thing, a lot of people were talking about this Luna task force that was looking into the JFK assassination and then asking for files to be released and opened up. And of course, it caught everyone's attention when Oliver Stone was there and Jim DiEugenio and others were there voicing their concerns of what should have been released and what should they be looking for. And how is it 62 years or so after the fact, they're still classifying or covering their asses? And so you have an article, why are we still declassifying JFK records? Critical AARB final determinations are buried and ignored. So that article is up at Kennedy's and King, and I urge everyone to read that. We'll be talking about that part one is up. Part two will be up almost any day, but stay tuned and we'll make links to everything as we do. So let me ask you, what was your impression of the Luna Investigation Committee on Federal Secrets?
Yeah, Len, you know, this was actually pretty exciting when they announced that Congress was going to strike a task force under the House Oversight Committee to look at the JFK assassination. I mean, really, this is the first time in 30 years since the ARRB disbanded in 1998, that Congress has taken any concrete steps with regard to the Kennedy assassination. The task force imposed on itself a fairly broad mandate, and it wasn't just the Kennedy assassination that they've decided to look at. They're also looking at the Robert Kennedy assassination, Martin Luther King, and other occurrences of the 1960s and more recent issues like the Epstein files, 9/11. I think they've given themselves an extremely broad mandate, and I'm worried that that broad mandate will take some of their focus away from the JFK assassination. But everyone has their own interests, and I know that there's a pretty vociferous part of the public that's really clamoring for the Epstein files. But I am really quite pleased with Representative Luna focusing the first two hearings on the JFK assassination. And I was thrilled to see the two panels of witnesses that she brought forward. The first on April the 1st included, obviously, Oliver Stone and Jim DiEugenio, as well as Jeff Morley. And another witness, I don't remember his name, but he was focused on kind of a really peripheral issue. But Oliver Stone, Jim, and Jeff did a spectacular job.
Just one of the things is that people have been so disappointed. They had high hopes for the House Select Committee and assassinations and even the AARB. And then we find out as it goes on that, well, the heads of these committees really believed the Warren Commission. And so they were just going through the motion with letting junior researchers dig up some stuff. But they kind of, in the back of their mind, had their mind made up that we're going to just go along with this one man, it's Lee Oswald, and that's it, lone assassin. And it's been kind of deflating to think that the government isn't doing a better job on investigating the murder of their leader.
Len, there have been a lot of people who've been highly critical of the task force and what's occurred. And I think you got to take a step back and you got to look at what the potential alternatives could have been. I mean, we had Oliver Stone, Jim DiEugenio, Jeff Morley, Dan Hardway, Abraham Bolden, Judge John Tunheim, and Doug Horne were the primary, and Dr. Curtis were the primary witnesses at two multi-hour hearings in front of Congress. And when you look at the testimony that they provided, really, you couldn't have asked for a stronger set of witnesses to lay out for the American public, really, a far more accurate history of the assassination. And when you think about Doug Horne's testimony, Doug Horne was the chief analyst for the assassination, military analyst for the Assassination Records Review Board. Up until he testified on May 20th, 2025, the American public had never seen it on national TV or broadcast nationally anyone that brought forward evidence to show that the Bethesda autopsy witnesses in great numbers saw the same head wounds on President Kennedy as were described by the Dallas treating physicians at Parkland Hospital. That itself is revelatory in terms of the real evidence being presented to the American people. And if you ask me, that one bit of testimony by Doug Horne really put into perspective the problems with A, the Warren Commission, and really B, the HSCA investigation in the mid and late 1970s that really was responsible for suppressing really critical evidence from the autopsy that showed that there was a blowout, large head wound in the back occipital region of President Kennedy's head. And the HSCA was, I think, just as culpable for covering that up as the Warren Commission was. And Doug Horne's testimony, it's now on Forbes' YouTube channel. And I think probably in the next couple of days, it's going to hit over 1 million views. So this is getting out there to the American public in a way that it has never gotten out before. So I think Representative Luna and her colleagues on the task force have done quite an exceptional job in changing the national dialogue on the Kennedy assassination. Now, that being said, the mainstream media really has fallen short. Forbes' YouTube channel is the only, I would call it, mainstream media to have covered this. You would think that Doug Horne testifying to there being three separate bullet headshots, President Kennedy's head, not one that we've been told for 60 years would be important enough news for ABC, CNN, MSNBC to cover, but they haven't touched it. They haven't mentioned it. It's not been in any of the mainstream media. And this was testimony that came out on May 20th. It's kind of shocking, the absolute silence in the mainstream media. And I mean, Dan Hardway's testimony as well was extremely important that the committee he worked on, the House Select Committee on Assassinations, were directly misled and obstructed by a CIA employee named George Joannides. And those two pieces of evidence in the last hearing, I think, were probably the most critical news on the assassination that's hit that's hit the American public in about 30 years.
I really like the fact that it started off kind of with a big punch from Oliver Stone and Jim DiEugenio. I mean, just those two guys got people's attention rather than they start off and they bring a few people and finally they wind up with a big conclusion. No, they started off with, hey, there's something really rotten. You should be declassifying these. You should not let them tell you what to do, although they always do, and everything's redacted. They're finally revealing stuff. And there's the old adage that if you left a Cadillac in Harlem 40, 50 years later, what do you expect to find? So how many of these things have been doctored? But there's people are interested. And there's concerned citizens are anyway, and they're taking the time to read what's there and connect the dots and
It was an absolute thrill and an honor to get to meet Oliver Stone. The fact is, he's the granddaddy of a lot of assassination researchers. His movie in 1991, JFK, really started probably most of the people that are in the current generation of researchers. His movie was a catalyst. And so not only did he bring star power to the hearing, his call for a new investigation from the scene of the crime right up to an autopsy or a new forensic examination, I think caught a lot of people off guard, and it caught a lot of people of a lot of people's attention. And you combine that with Doug Horne's sworn testimony ab about the medical evidence from Bethesda. I really do think the pressure is on for the Department of Justice to really take a new look at this.
now, do you want to give an overview of your article, the part one, which is already up at Kennedy's and the King?
Yeah, I can definitely do that. I'll
Okay.
give a little bit of a background. I've been working, I'm a lawyer in Ontario, Canada, and I've been interested in the Kennedy assassination for years, but I really started to focus in on the JFK Records Act, which was passed after Oliver Stone's film in 1992. And my attention grew because I knew that the JFK Records Act imposed a deadline for the release of all records on October 26, 2017. So about a year before that, I dusted off a copy of that I'd printed out of the JFK Records Act, and I started to read it, and I found it interesting. But as October 2017 drew closer, I really started to read that piece of legislation. I wanted to understand what would happen. And then October 26, 2017 came, and unfortunately, President Trump was persuaded by a number of senior agency officials, namely Mike Pompeo, that he shouldn't release the assassination records in accordance with the act. And once that happened, I absolutely drilled down on this and other areas of law to the point where I got involved in some serious legal research and drafting. And I mainly worked with Mark Adamczyk, an attorney down in Florida, in researching and drafting a lawsuit against President Biden, who won the 2020 election, and the National Archivist for the release of the records, because it became quite apparent to me and to Mark Adamczyk that a number of provisions in the JFK Records Act had not been complied with, in terms of the release of the records and how the continued postponements were made after 2017. And I wrote an article back in July of 2023 about the postponements. That's again on Kennedy's and King. It was about how President Biden had usurped Congress's authority over what are called non-executive branch records or congressional records. And that was a fairly lengthy article that got quite a bit of attention. This new article that was released on May 16 on Kennedy's and King really is a follow-up to that July 23 article. And what this article does is it really focuses in on these Assassination Record Review Board final agency orders that are called ARRB final determination notifications. And part one of my article really lays out kind of the legal framework that the JFK Records Act creates in order to fulfill its mandate of creating legislation that provides an accountable and enforceable law for the review and disclosure of assassination records. And these ARRB final determination notifications are really at the center of the work that the ARRB did between 1994, when its board members were appointed, and the end of September 1998, when the ARB wound up its operations and closed shop. What I've found through my research is that the ARRB was mandated by the law to issue final determinations, or their what they amount to are agency final orders. And in law, agency final orders really they carry legal ramifications and legal weight. They're like a court order, essentially. And the ARB had to issue one of these orders or final determinations for every single record that they reviewed. And between 1994 and 1998, the ARRB made decisions on over 27,000 separate JFK assassination records. Some of those records might have been over 250 pages long. Some of the records might have only been one page. But regardless, if the ARRB reviewed an assassination record and made a decision on that record, by law, they had to issue one of these agency final orders called a final determination. And because of the what these final determinations do is they provide written reasons for the postponement of information in the records. And usually these postponements mean redactions. Everyone's heard of redactions in the JFK assassination records. So the agencies would have told the ARRB, well, we don't want to disclose this name or this source or method in an assassination record. And so they would seek to redact that information. So sometimes it's just one word, sometimes it's a sentence, sometimes it's a paragraph or even a page that's redacted or blocked out from the public. And the ARRB, the board, they would look at each proposed redaction, they would make a decision, and they put those decisions on a redaction by redaction basis into these final determinations. And they're all written down, they're on a standard form, just like a court order, and they would give a basis for agreeing to continue the postponement of the information, or they would just release it. They would order the information released. And sometimes, a lot of times, the ARRB would order a future date for review of that postponement or a future date to release the postponement. And all of that information is contained in final determination forms. So these are legal documents issued by a independent federal agency. And because these final determinations carry such legally significant orders, one would think that that they would be front and center for the public, for the agencies, but especially for the National Archives, because the National Archivist had a legal duty to carry out the orders issued in these final determination forms. That's in the law. It's under Section 5G1 of the JFK Records Act. And that's directly placed on the Archivist of the United States to comply and implement the ARB's orders. But go and try finding copies of these final determinations. They're like unicorns in the JFK records. You might come across one periodically when a record is released, that the archives may actually attach these final determinations to the front of an assassination record. And so there's probably a few dozen or maybe at most a couple of hundred floating out there. But again, the ARB issued over 27,000 of these, one for every record. And I searched high and low to try to collect these records, and it's virtually impossible. In fact, I have yet to see an ARRB final determination notification that's been issued in 1997 or 1998 when the ARRB did the bulk of its work. What this led me to do, though, is myself and Jeff Crudell, he runs the JFK Enduring Secret podcast. Jeff Crudell and my co-author, Paul Blow, went down to College Park, Maryland, to the National Archives to search for these final determination forms. Before going, I'd communicated directly with both Judge Tunheim, the former chair of the ARRB, and surprisingly, I also was able to contact Dr. Jeremy Gunn, who is the former executive director and chief legal counsel for the ARRB back in the mid-90s. And both Judge Tunheim and Jeremy Gunn indicated that all of the ARRB's decisions were final determinations on the records that they reviewed. And Dr. Gunn clearly indicated that all of those final determinations should be available at the National Archives. They were created and issued in a way that they were meant to be publicly facing and accessible by the public. Just by their nature, they did not contain any classified information. And he even said that even for records that were withheld or remain classified, the final determinations regarding those records should not be classified, and they should be fully publicly available at the National Archives. Well, when Jeff, Paul, and I got to the archives in November last year, the archives only provided a box and a half of these final determinations. They were all from 1996, and there totaled about 450 ARRB final determinations. So again, there should be 27,000 of these records. What I was able to do with the help of Paul Blow was we put together a database of all of the final determinations that we were able to scan and collect at the National Archives. We put that into a shareable database, and then we cross-referenced each of the final determinations with the actual assassination record. And Len, what we found was actually quite shocking. We found four, and again, we only were able to get a sample of 450 of these final determinations. But what we found is that the ARRB, for several hundred of the in these final determinations, they ordered the associated assassination records released. They ordered them released in January of 2006. And when we cross-referenced the actual assassination records, we found that the National Archives did not release the records until 2018, 2021, 2023. And at the time, there were even some records that remained withheld, even though the ARRB ordered them to be publicly released in January of 2006. And again, these are legal, enforceable, binding, final agency orders that apply directly to the National Archivist. And under Section 5G1 of the JFK Records Act, the archivist had no discretion. The archivist had to follow the ARB's final agency orders. And again, several hundred of the records that we were able to get these final determinations for, the orders required the archivist to release these records in January 20, 2006. And that apparently was not complied with. In the course of the research for part one and for part two, I really looked at the specific laws in the JFK or provisions of the JFK Records Act, And it was pretty amazing. The work that they did, I really have to give Jeremy Gunn and David Marwell, who was the first and long-serving executive director, an awful lot of credit, especially Jeremy Gunn. This is a really professional lawyer who basically took the law and created policies and procedures for a brand new organization. And I've provided links to a lot of the original source material that was produced by Jeremy Gunn. And one of the really amazing things that I found is that they were very concerned about the president's authority to override the final determinations. And so in June of 1995, Jeremy Gunn drafted a memorandum of understanding between the ARRB and President Clinton's White House. And the memorandum of understanding, I've included excerpts of that in part one of the paper on Kennedy's and King. And it's just really incredible. Like, there are draft copies of this memorandum of understanding. And I questioned both Judge Tunheim and Jeremy Gunn about whether the White House signed it, whether there's a copy of the signed back memorandum of understanding. And they couldn't recall whether there was in fact a signed copy of the memorandum of understanding. And you know, Len, this is really important because what it essentially says, the law required the president to certify the release or postponement of each decision of the ARRB within 30 days of the ARRB issuing their final determination. And when you think there's 27,000 of these, what time would President Clinton have to actually issue written certifications for each ARRB decision? And so Jeremy Gunn said, this is ridiculous. The law is actually creating an impossibility. The president does not have time to do this. And so that was the impetus for him to draft this memorandum of understanding. And what Jeremy Gunn did in the memorandum of understanding is that he basically said that if the president wishes to override an ARRB decision, he has to do so in writing. But if the president is silent on an ARRB final determination, then that's his certification and consent. And having a written executed copy of the memorandum of understanding is therefore very important. And I looked everywhere in the archives, I couldn't find anything. Judge Tunheim didn't recall. He believed that they executed it, but he didn't have any record of it. And he couldn't recall with absolute certainty. Anyway, Len, I contacted the Clinton Library in Arkansas and I wrote them. And lo and behold, a week later, they sent me copies of all of the internal White House memos on the ARB Memorandum of Understanding. And they sent me a copy of President Clinton's approval of the Memorandum of Understanding. And so this is, I believe, it's never seen before. And it's included as a hyperlink in the article. But it's pretty amazing stuff to see that the president actually approved this Memorandum of Understanding. And so what that means is, that if the president didn't override an ARB decision in writing, then that ARB decision became binding and enforceable law 30 days after the ARRB issued their final determinations. And no one's ever looked at this before. And so the article really gets down into the nitty-gritty about this. And I'm really quite pleased with the reception that I've got with regard to this article. and the law that is really clearly set out. And you know, I've taken a lot of internal ARRB memos and legal interpretations from Jeremy Gunn that are accessible on the National Archives website, and I got to credit Dr. Gunn for the amazing legal work that he did in creating this framework for the release and review of these records.
Right. Is there any way to explain how there's only 450 when there should be, you said, 27,000?
Yeah, you know, that's a whole that I'm gonna really explain this in part two of my article. Part two really looks at what Congress did to ensure that these ARRB final determinations get out there to the public, to the agencies, and so that they were seen to be the important legal documents that they are. The fact is that the ARRB had a duty to publish all of these final determinations in an annual report that was sent to Congress, that was sent to the National Archives each year. They had to include an appendix with copies of all of the final determinations. Well, they did that in 1995, but they did not do that in any of the other years that they were in existence. So there's an annual report in 1996, but they didn't include an appendix with all of the final determinations in 96. And what I found, the ARB didn't even produce an annual report in 97 or 98. So that was one of the ways that Congress was going to ensure that these final determinations become public. So only, I think there was 301 final determinations published in the 1995 annual report. And after that, no final determinations were published. Well, Congress also required that the ARRB issue the final determinations and send them to the originating agencies that created the assassination records. But also, more importantly, the ARRB had to attach a final determination notification to each assassination record when they transferred those records to the National Archives. So the National Archives really should have all 27,000 copies of the final determination notifications. And I put in written requests for them. I attended the archives for 3 days with Jeff Crudell and Paul Blow, and all I got was the 450 copies. I've subsequently put in a FOIA request to the National Archives for the production of all 27,000 ARRB final determination notifications. I believe I did that in late March or April. I got an acknowledgement of receipt, but the National Archives has not followed through with a response. So the next step is to file a lawsuit to have the court enforce the Freedom of Information Act and for the production of these records. There's no reason why they should be withholding these records. These are absolutely assassination records. They don't contain any classified information. They've been made public, and both Judge Tunheim and Jeremy Gunn say that all of these records should absolutely be public. The JFK Records Act says that these should be publicized. And made available through a number of different routes. So the archives really does not have a leg to stand on in denying access to these records. And Len, really, it's quite shocking that that they would sit on absolutely the most important records that the ARB produced during its 4 years of existence. The whole point of the Assassination Records Review Board was to review and issue these final determinations to release these records. And the fact that the National Archives has not complied with its Section 5G1 duty, its ministerial duty to comply with the ARB orders is surprising. But you know, one of the sections in part two of the article is subtitled, "Is This Serial Negligence or Are These the Mechanics of Suppression?" Because really, we're looking at an either-or situation. And the whole concept of serial negligence is extremely problematic. So, I mean, in my view, there have been so many things that have come out over the last 60 years where various institutions basically go, oops, oh, we didn't know that that existed, or oops, we didn't mean to destroy that evidence, or oops, the Secret Service destroyed all of the motorcade records for 1963 after the JFK Act required them to preserve them. The whole concept of serial negligence becomes laughable at some point. And I think when it comes to these final determinations, this is where the rubber needed to hit the road legally. The act is explicitly clear that the archivist of the United States had a duty to comply with the ARB final determinations. And even on the sample of the 450 that we obtained last November, it is quite clear when you look at the release dates for many of these assassination records. Again, the ARB ordered these records released, not to be reviewed. They ordered the records released in January of 2006. And a good number of the records were not released until after 2018. And some of them were released only this year, in March of this year. So it's quite shocking. And I hope that the task force undertakes to look at this because it's a very serious transgression of a federal statute. And what it amounts to is records that were supposed to be released in 2006, they were delayed for 20 years. And that's, I think we can see information is coming out from these records that's startling. It's taking solid researchers quite a bit of time to pore through all the records that have been released. And the other thing that I think is concerning, and this was addressed in the original lawsuit that I researched and drafted, a significant problem is that there's no comprehensive and complete index or directory of assassination records being held at the National Archives. And so it's a little bit of a game of whack-a-mole, or multiple releases, and they're kind of lifting a veil one sheet at a time on these records. And there's no way of knowing what's actually being fully released, what's still in there. A lot of records do not have what's called a RIF number or record identification number. And as we're finding out, a lot of records were kind of moved over to the National Archives before the JFK Records Act was passed in October of 1992. And there's a section of the act, I think it's 5D3 of the JFK Records Act, that said if an agency transfers assassination records to the National Archives before the passage of the act, then those records don't automatically get a RIF number, and therefore they're not automatically reviewed by the Assassination Records Review Board. They kind of go into a bit of a black hole. And I discovered an internal CIA memorandum dated February of 1992, so 8 months before the JFK Records Act was passed. And basically, the CIA is, for all intents and purposes, they're trying to strategize how to circumvent the pending passage of the JFK Records Act. And it was the recommendation of the author of this 1992 memo that the CIA transfer its entire House Select Committee on Assassination files to the archives before the JFK Records Act was passed, so that they wouldn't receive RIF numbers and it would be up to the archivist whether those records entered into the purview of the ARRB. It's stupefying. I just came across that memorandum. I can send you a link to it. It's really quite shocking. But they basically spell out a strategy on how to circumvent the JFK Records Act, and I believe they did, because there's no real reliable accounting for what records were included in that and which ones filtered their way into the review of the Assassination Records Review Board. And this isn't an issue that just, you know, I've recently discovered. Joe Bax, who's an absolutely spectacular files-focused researcher, he identified this back in 1998. And I read an email that he sent to the ARRB back in 1998, identifying just a massive trove of records shipped by the CIA to the National Archives that didn't receive RIF numbers. So, you know, Len, this story on the records is not anywhere close to finished. I think if the Luna Committee does anything, they need to call the archivist or the acting archivist in and get some serious answers as to what happened with both these final determinations and with the full state of the records, including records that were not reviewed by the ARRB.
Yeah, I guess in essence, they made them unsearchable then?
Yeah, you know, it's like almost anything else. You have to know exactly what you're looking for. And if you don't know exactly what you're looking for, you're never going to find it. And so it's like Donald Rumsfeld's unknown unknowns. And that's why the JFK Records Act really made the indexing and cataloging and issuance of identification aids a real priority as part of their accountability and transparency provisions in the JFK Records Act. And that, in my mind, was the critical focus of suing the archivist who is responsible for creating the catalog and index of records in the collection. I mean, people are, if you go into the National Archives, which I've been fortunate enough to do, like it's an amazing facility and the staff are very professional. But if you don't know precisely what you're looking for, it's so massive and things are I don't want to say hidden away, but you just can't randomly go through, you know, box after box after box. You have to specifically request numbered boxes. And if something's made impossible to find, like these final determination notifications, then good luck trying to find them. I am quite certain at some point in time, they are going to have to release all of the final determination notifications. It would save a lot of effort if Congress ordered the National Archives to release all of these records. And then the American public can see to what extent the work of the ARB was thwarted between 1998 and today. And we'll be able to see whether there's still records that the ARB ordered released that remain withheld. Because that picture is, it's not just fuzzy. There's no picture there because we don't have, you know, 26,500 of these final determination forms.
Well, shouldn't the former heads of the AARB be more upset about this?
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to answer this carefully. They had no legal duty once the ARB wound up its operations. Okay. So I'm talking a strict legal duty. Once the ARB issued these notifications, the legal onus and duty to comply with them landed squarely on the archivist of the United States. You would think that there would be other kinds of motivation to go, hey, What happened to those tens of thousands of legal final orders that we issued? Were they complied with? There at minimum, you would think that there would be a curiosity, right? And I think there is a curiosity now, but come 2001 or 2006, when large numbers of these orders started to roll out, a lot of the ARB senior staff and the board members, only Judge Tunheim is left from the 5-member board. The other members of the board have passed away. Unfortunately, I'm going to just clarify. Fortunately, we still have Judge Tunheim, who's been quite outspoken on the state of the records. And I would hope that he looks at these issues regarding the final determinations and contacts the Luna Committee, because they are really drilling down on areas of suppression, obstruction, and obfuscation. That's their bread and butter of this task force. So I hope Judge Tunheim does speak up about these final determination notifications. I think he has an extremely important voice in this matter. This was his board. And you know what? He was at the center of making all of these decisions.
That's what I'm kind of getting at, that if he doesn't, though, that just kind of shows that these guys don't want this to come out. I mean, they're covering every angle year after year after year. There's some reason
I
why,
have hope. I have hope, Len. I mean, now that I've raised this, I think it's out there, and either it's going to have to be dismissed or it's going to have to be accepted. And I think the law is pretty clear, and that's why I've gone to such great lengths to use the original legal analyses and findings and policies that guided the ARRB from 94 to 98. Like, I've scraped probably several hundred thousand internal email between legal counsel at the ARB, discussing all of these issues in order to really understand their thought processes. I've taken excerpts from their legal memoranda. And Jeremy Gunn was a brilliant lawyer, and thank God the ARB had him. I can't sing his praises enough. He has not stepped out at all, really, since leaving the ARB to comment on the JFK records since 1998, when I think he left work at the board. He's probably the most knowledgeable guy in the JFK Records Act and the legal framework of the ARRB. One of the most interesting things that I did is during my research for this is that I spoke with the computer specialist that was with the ARRB from the very beginning until its very last day. And he created the entire review and computer tracking system for all of the records. And this guy was just fascinating to talk to. And when he told me that in the final days of the ARB's operation, they were just pumping out massive numbers of these final determinations. And I think there's a quote in the article by this guy named, I think it's Peter Voth, and it kind of cracked me up because it shows the desperation that the ARB was under in the final days. And Peter Voth, he wrote an email to all of the ARB staff. So there were probably a couple of dozen staff members still there in the last few weeks. And he wrote, this is again Peter Voth. It's regarding the back printer, and this was written on September 22nd, so 8 days before the final day of the ARB's operations. And he goes, because the CIA team needs to print out approximately 14,000 final determination forms, bracket, no joke. If I was just pulling a number out of a hat, I don't think I'd pick 14,000. End bracket. We have staged a hostile takeover of the back printer. Please change your printer to one of the other ones and let me know if you want help with this. We apologize for the inconvenience. So then, 8 days before the ARB wound up all of its operations, you know, they had to print 14,000 final determination notifications and staple them on the front of each assassination record before they took those records over to the National Archives. This was a major operation, and at the center of it was these final determination forms, which again amount to agency legal final orders regarding each of the records and the postponements in those records. So this, there are some people out there who are saying, yeah, this is not true. But you know what? This is all directly from ARRB internal memos, legal opinions, and internal email. These final determinations were at the very epicenter of the ARB's work for the 4 years that it was in existence. And you know, the computer system specialist, he was responsible at the very, very end for basically packaging up the ARB computer system, all of the servers and data storage, and taking it over to the National Archives so that the National Archives could continue to maintain that system. And that system was based on the Lotus Notes platform. It's essentially a tracking system, and it had a calendar and diarizing component to it that would notify when records were up for review or release. And this fella, he said he was never contacted by the National Archives, even though he offered to continue to help them maintain that computer system. And he was disappointed that they never even contacted him.
Well, that's just letting you know that they didn't want it to come out then.
Yeah, you know, I got to say, it appears that a lot of this lies at the feet of the National Archivist at that time, well, throughout the time since the ARB wound up, because all of the legal duties were on the National Archivist from 1998 onwards to release these records. And I find it almost inexplicable that these ARB final determinations appear to have been buried and ignored for almost 2 decades, 3 decades.
Quite inexplicable if you're looking at it from a reasonable point of view. But if you're saying these are the guys that are in charge of covering it up, despite people like, well, in the old days, you know, Dan Hardway and Eddie Lopez and that, but people were doing honest work. Some of these things pop up, they've got to keep them hidden, or like you say, obfuscate them, don't give them the right tracking number, RIF number, whatever, to just, and then hog all the printers so they don't even have time to print them.
Yeah, like I say, is it serial negligence, or is this the mechanics of suppression? I that's a topic that I get into in part two. I do talk in detail about the trip to the archives, and you know, there are some photographs that I took while I was at archives, and it's actually pretty amazing. The 450 final determination notifications that I was able to obtain and scan and so I digitized them immediately as soon as I realized that I had actually got some. But when they were all in a box that was labeled press and public contacts, and when you look at that label, it has nothing to do with the fact that those are the most important legal orders issued by the ARRB, and they're in a box labeled press and public contacts. It defies searching, and it defies any explanation. And when, I mean, even when we did ask the archivist, the senior JFK archivist at the National Archives, does this make any sense that these documents are in a box labeled press and public contacts. And he had no explanation. He was even confused. So I don't think it was his fault. Again, all of the staff that we dealt with at the National Archives were highly professional. And I wouldn't call them extremely helpful. But if you ask them for something specifically, then they would usually try to help.
Well, they were competent.
Yeah, I would call them competent. Yeah, which kind of again defies the whole concept of serial negligence, doesn't it? It's such a unique story, and I mean, listen, it's the nexus of law and reality on the ground at the National Archives. And I gotta, I have to give some appreciation to Mark Adamczyk. He and I worked closely for years in researching the JFK Records Act, and Mark was an editor of Part One. And I do appreciate all of his sounding board and sage advice on part one. And there were other people who were absolutely pivotal in that piece. It's a long piece, but hopefully people take time to understand because it really does show where the gaps were in that has allowed the government to keep tens of thousands of records held in secret for 30 years when many of them should have been released back in the early and mid 2000s.
And you can bet if they said Lee Oswald had anything to do with this, they would be waving them around. You'd have them in duplicate, triplicate. But that's not what these are.
Front page of the New York Times. Yeah, that'll never happen.
Okay,
But
we'll urge everybody to read this part one and part two. Also, you mentioned to me that you're going to be speaking, and I'd like to help promote that little conference that if we can get into that.
yeah, I'm really excited. Dealey Plaza UK, which can be found online at dealeyplazauk.com, is having their 30th anniversary seminar in Warwickshire, England, at the end of this month between June 27th and 29th. And I'm quite proud to have been asked to speak at the conference, and I'll be speaking about the final determinations on Saturday. And Neil Safady has put together an absolutely fantastic conference with a great set of speakers at an amazing facility. I think it's called Ashbourne Hill, just outside of Warwickshire. And it's in a pretty amazing looking place. But if your listeners are interested in this, they can certainly go to the Dealey Plaza UK.com website and look up 30th anniversary conference. Yeah, the speakers range from Scott Reed and Gary Severson, Matt Dowitt, the Grodens, Robert Groden and his wife are attending, Paul Abbott, Bart Camp, Chris Gallup, Barry Keane, David Ward, Johnny Cairns, so quite a few, and Paul Blow is also going to speak on I think Sunday afternoon. But Neil Safady, I believe, is the secretary of Dealey Plaza UK. Malcolm Blunt, I hear, is going to be there, and so I'm looking forward to meeting everyone there and to presenting some of my research. They've been very kind in giving me a spot to talk on Saturday. Very excited.
Yeah, very good. Have you done anything with them before?
I've spoken to quite a few of their members, just on an individual basis, but no, this will be the first time that that I've taken part in anything that they've done. I was planning on attending their remote conference about 2 years ago, and I think Paul Blow attended either last year's conference or the year before last. And he had a lot of amazing things to say. This is an exemplary group of historians and researchers over there. And I don't know. I couldn't be prouder to be taking part in this. It's a great privilege.
Very good, very good. Well, we've got your articles here, mentioning that you're going to be speaking. What's in the new future then? Will there are you going to be covering, I guess, anything more that the Luna Committee does do?
Yeah, I'm not sure what's going to happen in the next couple of months. I understand the task force has extended its mandate for another 6 months, so that should take us into the fall. I'm not sure how many more JFK related hearings they're going to conduct, but I think there's a few witnesses that they would be. That would be really beneficial to call. And maybe what we'll see is some current institutional leaders in at the archives from the CIA be called for questioning from the Secret Service to explain some of this. And at the end of the day, if there is a referral to the Department of Justice, I think that would be that would be the best thing. I don't think Congress is really well equipped to do a thorough investigation. That's really more in the realm of the Department of Justice or a special counsel or something of that nature. I do hope that there's at least one more JFK related public hearing before they get into I don't know, UFOs and the Epstein files.
Right. Who would you like to have called?
You know, I from the very beginning, I really quite vocal about Doug Horne being called. I would like to see Dan Rather. Dan Rather has a lot of explaining to do about what he reported on the Zapruder film. I think it would be a it would be amazing thing to for Dan Rather to be the subject of a subpoena. And I've said this as well. I think Andy Purdy, who was and Robert Blakey, both counsel for the House Select Committee on Assassinations. I would like to know how did so many of the Bethesda witnesses' evidence and testimony get suppressed in the mid and late 1970s during the HSCA? Who's responsible for that? What happened? Because the ARRB laid it all bare for everyone to see if they took the time to read the information and depositions that were released by the ARRB in the 1990s. I think that's probably the most obvious evidence of suppression and obstruction in the JFK records case. I mean, for 60 years, the American public were told that the Dallas doctors were wrong. They didn't look at President Kennedy's wounds. They didn't. The director of neurosurgery didn't know where the occiput was and couldn't identify cerebellum. And that the American public should listen to the military autopsy conclusions rather than expert trauma doctors and the chair of neurosurgery. When in reality, many of the Bethesda witnesses testified to seeing exactly what the Dallas doctor saw. This should be on the front page of every major newspaper on and on every network broadcast, primetime news. This is really key information.
Well, I'd like
And
to see Blakey kind of atone for his sins because what he said now is he goes, I was duped. I didn't realize the scope of it. And I'm paraphrasing, I'm not quoting him, but it's just that he was naive to the degree in which the CIA would lie to him and make him, doubt his own researchers. And then to the fact that years later, I mean, I even interviewed him and I just went light on him because I just wanted to hear what he had to say. But I mean, it's a total letdown for people like that to be in charge of something when they're not doubting every piece of information that the FBI brings up from the Warren Commission. I mean, years later, he goes, "Oh my God, Joannides! Now I know what he did for a living, and they brought him out of retirement, and he got a medal for what he pulled over on the American public and him." So.
At minimum, Len, I think they owe a serious explanation under cross-examination, not some friendly, questioning. They need to be cross-examined about this, so that they can't continue the obfuscation, whether they were directly responsible or not. Is still a question that needs to be determined. And I think a real cross-examination, they'll have a chance to explain what happened. And whether, like, I don't really care about, like, give them immunity, whatever. It's all okay with me. What the American people want is the truth, right? No one's saying that any of the guys on the HSCA were directly responsible or indirectly responsible for the assassination. But if they know what happened in order to suppress information, then I think they owe it to the American people. And you know what? They should clear their consciences, even if they were not directly responsible. If they know what happened, they should advise the American people. And I think that would be really healing for everyone. And again, not saying that they were directly responsible, Blakey or Purdy, but it would make sense that they were in positions to know what happened, whether they were responsible or not. I think we have to be careful then in placing blame on people without sufficient evidence. And I just think they should be questioned because they were in positions where they ought to have known.
Right, but that's the point there. They're in the position they ought to have known, they should have known. And as any lawyer, if you're going to look at both sides, they say don't ask a client a question unless you know the answer or, on the stand, right? So what they've done is they've gone along with the cover up. And they said, these guys wouldn't lie to me. Don't worry. We're going to, we're representing the best of the American people. And then, years later, they found out, wow, they did lie to us. We've been duped. I mean, if you read between the lines with, that's my take on Blakey. But Dan Hardway, who was a friend of Blakey's, right? I mean, they kind of reveal that we were sabotaged at every level. And these
Yeah,
are high levels.
I don't think we can say with any certainty until we actually have evidence that, they knowingly went along. I don't think we can say that. But I think by having them questioned under oath, and cross in a kind of cross-examination, I do think that that we can get closer to the truth of exactly what happened. Right? I mean, maybe they have a completely benign explanation. And if they do, they should be given the chance to express that. It's yeah, it's a difficult situation. I imagine it's a difficult situation for them too. If they do know what happened, why would they want to not have a chance to explain it. You know, I think it's a very healthy thing for people to share that kind of information that's remained secret for years.
Well, for one reason, it's going to be totally embarrassing. Like in the case of Blakey, he's come forward with a little bit of an apology, more than I expected, and it was like, you know, okay, thank you for at least saying that much. You know, that it's been a total shock that how much he was lied to, and how much he accepted what the state told him were the facts, and he went along with that, and now he finds out that that wasn't the truth. So, I mean, he hasn't testified to that, right? But
I hope they're and this is why, yeah, Blakey, Andy Purdy, Dan Rather, I think they have a
I don't
chance.
think Dan Rather will ever. He'll just say, "That's what I saw. I saw his head go forward, and that's what I reported." And you know, what are you going to do about that?
Yeah, they should be given the chance to
Fair enough,
they
but
should
like
be
you say,
given they should be
the
given a chance to openly and fairly state for the record. And you know what? They're not getting any younger, none of them.
I
And
know, but for instance, like I say, that at least, you know, Professor Blakey has come forward to say that in some areas here, he was wrong, and he was duped, and he was lied to. Now, I don't know how far it goes, but with Dan Rather, I don't think he'll ever. I just that guy is such a phony TV, you know, type personality that for him to admit that, then people will say, "Well, if you're lying about this, what were you reporting on Sirhan Sirhan, and what were you reporting on Martin Luther King's assassination, or
Yeah, there's so many things in that.
John Lennon, or just so many, you know." And it goes on and on. It goes on and on. That's why I think we're interested, because if we find out the truth and we find out something very important, we've got to stop that from happening again. And we're kind of powerless about that, right? And it's almost unbelievable that somebody as divisive as Trump has ordered this, and it's almost a backlash to the FBI that had all these phony, and if you want to use the word witch hunt, did the Russiagate, all these, in my opinion, charges that are just a character assassination, the P tape, this and that. He's a Putin puppet, and you know, on and on and on. And you know, I don't like him. I'm not sticking up for him. I'm just saying there's two sides to the coin. The FBI manufactured so many things on him that he said, "Tell you what, you're going to get a bit of your own medicine, right? So I'm going to release these files. I'm going to release them." And then, you know, it's gone a little soft. I mean, you know, I'm saying thank goodness for like Oliver Stone and Jim DiEugenio that were there, and for anybody
Yep.
who was interested could watch. And all you've
Yeah,
got to
my
do
big
is.
concern going forward, Len, is that there, I think the research community needs to be extremely wary of there being a limited hangout. And we need to make sure that everyone involved, stays true to legitimate and fulsome research of the whole story, and that this isn't all laid at the feet of someone like James Angleton, when James Angleton was clearly an important player in the 1960s, but he certainly wasn't the only player in this story. And that's my big worry at this point. And sadly, when you're talking about Trump and you're talking about Blakey, and the sad thing I think that we're learning is that there are really no heroes. And if you're expecting someone to ride in on a white horse, you're going to be sorely disappointed in the JFK assassination story.
Well, we
There
had Jim Garrison, so that, you
are
know, that was for me anyway. And then, you know, right now we have Oliver Stone.
Yes. Yeah.
And so
Yeah, I'm going to
we'll take it.
agree. Oliver Stone
Yeah.
has done an amazing job over the last 30 years telling the stories to get people motivated. And what a wonderful contribution he's made.
Right, and with the last documentary, he made the four part one with Destiny Betrayed, written by Jim DiEugenio. It's another great documentary of what we know. 30 years after the crime, he made the movie, and now 30 years after the movie, we even know more.
I love that documentary. And I will say this, if we could end on this amazing note, I know you spoke with Paul Blow, I think last week, and Paul has done such an amazing job with the French version of our book, The JFK Assassination Chokeholds. He launched the French book last week, and it was recently released in France as well. And the reception in France has been fairly spectacular over the last couple of days. And in Quebec, on Amazon.ca, so across Canada, the French book was the number one book in so many different categories on Amazon.ca. It's like struck a nerve in the French speaking world. It seems to be catching fire in France right now. And I couldn't be prouder to I've worked very closely with Paul. And he's such a wonderful gentleman and such an amazing researcher. He has done a tremendous job with a lawyer from Quebec named Marc Barnard in translating chokeholds to French. It took them several months, but that is not an easy job to translate a whole book to French. I love the title, L'Irréfutable. It's selling like hotcakes in the French speaking world.
Okay, very good. Let's do that. Let's have that a high note that we're ending on.
Sounds good, Len.
Okay, Andrew, thank you so much for taking time today. Keep up the good work, and I'll keep in touch, and I'll have you on to talk about whatever new articles that you're writing and research that you're doing. I'm always interested in.
Thanks so much, Len. It's always a pleasure.
Okay, good night.